On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Each time you have to say stories about women are relevant, stories about women connect to our lives, and stories about women can be profitable. That sort of repeat process, unfortunately, remains.
Director Todd Haynes has established himself as an indie filmmaker who creates memorable roles for women, including with his newest film, Carol. It stars Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, Oscar-nominated for Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress. Haynes and Carol producer Christine Vashon tell us that their past success didn't make it any easier for them to find money when financiers learned there would be no male leads in their movie. But first on the News Banter, a slave rebellion movie makes Sundance history, and the Motion Picture Academy has really stirred the pot with its answer to Oscar's So White. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, let's talk about Sundance first. Let's start.
It was very, very, very cold.
I was glad I was not there. I chickened out this year. But still, it was fun, right? There was a lot to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the big, big news of the festival is that there was a film, Birth of a Nation, that set a record, a $17.5 million deal with Fox Searchlight for worldwide rights, more than any film at any festival has ever gotten from a buyer.
That is astounding. It played incredibly well. This filmmaker, Nate Parker, who talk about a passion project, you know, really gave up everything to get this film made based on a slave rebellion led by Nat Turner, which is a thing that actually did happen. And what is astonishing, not only is the $17 million price that was paid by Fox Searchlight, but a bidding war in which Netflix went to $20 million, and he turned that down.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big thing. You know, Netflix and Amazon have made a lot of news at Sundance for buying films, but this was the prize film. This was the one that drew the most attention. It's, you know, a zeitgeisty film. It's going to be injected into this Oscars So White conversation because it'll be an awards film next year. And Netflix offered $20 million, and he said no. He preferred to go with Fox Searchlight, he said, because they had a track record with these kinds of films. They released 12 Years a Slave, which won Best Picture. And he said he just had a great conversation with them, and they agreed. He wants this film to be shown in schools. He wants this film to be shown in theaters. It just shows that with all the hoopla about Netflix, Amazon, and these streaming services, that filmmakers do like to see their films in theaters.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because in the beginning, it seemed like the big noise was Netflix paying $7 million for a Paul Rudd movie, Amazon paying $10 million for a film from Kenneth Lonergan called Manchester by the Sea. And those were big numbers for streaming rights in some cases.
Oh, huge, huge numbers. And don't get me wrong, Birth of a Nation is an outlier. The story of the festival this year is Netflix and Amazon showing up in a huge way, taking streaming video rights off the table for enormous prices and basically shutting out these traditional independent film distributors who go in and buy, you know, a movie here and there, $2 million, $3 million, $1 million. Those people have just been completely overshadowed by Netflix and Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of amazing. We would think $7 million would be a good price for a Sundance movie, period. Then these guys come in. And of course, these distributors, they don't want to have the streaming rights gone when they buy these movies. They'd like to buy the whole enchilada. A lot of times movies do better in an afterlife than they do theatrically. And here is this disruption from Netflix and Amazon.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out, because when Amazon bought the Kenneth Lonergan movie, we were told that we should hang tight because there would be a theatrical distributor announced along with Amazon later that day. That hasn't happened, and we're going on a week now. So I think a lot of theatrical distributors are wary of getting involved with a film that already has a huge Netflix or Amazon deal because it doesn't feel as special, and it's not going to be a gigantic release, and the audiences are getting used to these films being on the streaming services, so they're less inclined to see it in theaters.
Yeah, it's going to cause some difficult choices for independent filmmakers going forward, I think. Meanwhile, you mentioned Oscar So White. We walked through the basic rule changes last week with the Hollywood Reporter's awards coverage person, Scott Feinberg. There has been, this is obviously an attempt to accelerate diversity in the membership of the Motion Picture Academy and hopefully nominations that are not, as they were in all the acting categories for 2 years in a row, completely white. But it is not an easy situation. The Academy pushed rules forward that will push some older white voters out of the membership, and a lot of them are really steamed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting phenomenon that's going on. You know, the heads of the Academy, Cheryl Boone Isaacs and Dawn Hudson, did an interview with Hollywood Reporter this week in which they said, you know, this is not about political correctness. This is not about ageism. This is about making the Academy more reflective of the filmmaker universe and of the universe in general. And yet you have one after another, a lot of these aggrieved Academy members coming forward and putting their names on guest columns that we've been running all week saying, this is outrageous. I've deserved my shot to vote in these movies. I'm a professional. I've been in this business for 30 years. You know, some of them are more reasoned than others. Some have said things like, you know, you don't see the NBA going after Eskimo and Asian players and
which
things like that.
Which ironically, of course, highlights the exact problem of the of sort of
right.
the unconscious racism that exists in the Academy to some degree, and you can argue how much. And
yeah,
in the world,
absolutely.
Let me say, in fairness, you know, we did a panel also with various people of color who are in this business, and one of them said, more than one of them, it's a general consensus, this is not about the Academy per se. This is an institutional societal problem that is reflected in the Academy, and this is a microcosm of a larger drama that's playing out across this country.
Right, but the fact is, though, the Academy has now chosen to be a leader on this subject. You know, they are at the tail end of the Hollywood system. They are only presented with the films that are greenlit, made, and presented to them as awards movies.
Very good point, yes.
You know, they don't necessarily have any responsibility for the problem, but they are taking responsibility and they are doing what they can within their rules to try to promote different types of people in the Academy, different types of people being hired, different types of movies being in the awards conversation. And their hope is that by doing this, they will encourage diverse choices within the rest of the industry by pointing out that these are the kinds of movies that could be nominated for Best Picture, that these are the kinds of people that can serve on the Academy's Board of Governors, which is the, you know, one of the greater honors in the industry.
You know, it's kind of sad because you've had a group of people who have long felt disenfranchised and now people who feel that they are about to be disenfranchised. And it's just a lot of hurt feelings all around. And
I get it. I mean, yeah. I totally get it. If I was in the Academy for 30 years and I, you know, was voting with my conscience and with my artistic heart on these movies, and then I was all of a sudden told that my opinion is outdated and not valid, I'd be pissed.
And people are. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter.
So what kind of name is Belovin?
It's Czech. It's changed originally.
It's very original.
Well.
And your first name?
Therese.
Therese, not Teresa.
No.
Therese Belovet. That's lovely.
And yours?
Carol.
That's Kate Blanchett as an unhappily married woman and Rooney Mara as a fetching shop girl in the new movie Carol, a love story set in the early 1950s. Our guests today are the director and producer of Carol, Todd Haynes, and Christine Vachon. The two are longtime friends and collaborators who first met as students at Brown University in the 1980s. And together, they've made films including Safe and Far From Heaven, as well as the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce. When they joined us at KCRW, we talked about one of their first projects, Superstar, a 1987 biopic of singer Karen Carpenter. The short film used Barbie dolls to tell the story of the singer's rise to fame and struggle with anorexia that led to her death at the age of 32. Haynes wrote and directed Superstar, and Vachon helped with the editing and sound mix. Karen Carpenter is voiced by Meryl Groover and her brother Richard by Michael Edwards.
So sick of road food.
Just 2 more months to go. We'll see.
I know. We'll be home for 2 weeks. It's just wearing on me.
Well, you don't take care of yourself, Ken. You don't eat. I really think this diet of yours is the problem. I mean, Karen, you look really thin.
I like the way I look.
Superstar was not well received by Richard Carpenter, which led to legal trouble for Haynes.
I just wanted to be able to make this movie and maybe get it shown somewhere. I didn't have really ambitions for it beyond that. And yet we knew that if it ever did see more attention, that it had definite legal problems attached to it.
You knew going in.
We knew going in. But I just had very modest expectations when I made the film.
Did you not win a fight over Barbie, the use of Barbie?
You know, yeah, or at least what happened was there was a little bit of sniffing around the project from Mattel.
They actually sent a cease and desist.
It wasn't Barbie that sent a cease and desist. There was a lawyer that I knew
right.
who did some pro bono sort of investigating of the situation with Mattel and reached out to Mattel. I think showed them the film because we did get sent to us the legal patents to Barbie's body. In several pieces, it was kind of creepy, like the head patent and the arm patent and the leg patent to demonstrate who owned the original pieces
wow.
of Barbie. This all fell so well into the themes that were already in Superstar, a film that dealt with anorexia nervosa.
Dark, yes.
But very dark. But what was very interesting is I think they very quickly saw that there was a much bigger legal problem afoot with this film, and it was the music rights.
Which is always a problem.
Which is always a problem. And they basically just stepped away. And, you know, I knew we were reckless and that we didn't pursue anything professionally or seriously. It just wasn't in our minds, you know. But the film, because it did get reviewed by Jay Hoberman in The Village Voice.
The Village Voice, yeah.
And Barbara Kruger, who was writing for Art Forum at the time. When those journalists saw the film and Hoberman featured it, it put it on the map in ways that is no longer true today for The Village Voice or maybe any single publication, the way it had that kind of reach nationally.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you know, museums and art centers and small venues wanted to show the film.
But Richard didn't care for it at all, and you were supposed to pull all copies or destroy all copies, I think, right?
We were then served with three cease and desists, all oriented around A&M Records and Richard Carpenter's estate. And this was after the film had shown for 3 years. And we sort of knew this was all coming because the film was getting a lot of attention and people were writing about it and were very excited about it. The film was even starting to be shown at anorexia centers as a kind of learning tool, as something that would sort of provoke discussion about the issues. And I just felt that I had gotten a tremendous amount out of the film, but I also felt that it actually had a life of its own almost by this point. And I just asked, we just requested, was there any way that we could at least let the film be shown in these non-theatrical venues, academic or whatever.
And any money would go back to the Karen Carpenter Foundation.
Exactly. And they said no. The one caveat they did maintain for us was that I could show the film to journalists in relationship to my other work. And so that was a little window.
And yet it lives.
It does.
Well, you know, for years it lived as, you know, people had third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation copies of it that they would pass around. Kim's Video would rent it in the East Village if you gave them a password. But I actually shut that down.
What was the password?
I don't know. I shut that down because I didn't think it was right for them to earn money on
right.
something that, you know, no one else was earning money on, et cetera.
And we didn't want to be held responsible
exactly.
for it.
Exactly.
Shown. So
right,
that's one place we happen to live, and we could
right.
say, you guys, you got to take it off the shelf.
But then along came the internet, and all bets were off.
Right. I heard it sort of exists, at least in bits and pieces, on YouTube.
I think it comes up, and then it gets taken down, and it has
yeah,
that kind of back
it's like
and forth.
Like whack-a-mole.
I mean, when I go and speak at colleges to, you know, there was a long stretch where students had never heard of it, and I was like, oh, that's so terrible. But now that is so not the case. And when I say, who's seen Superstar, you know, 2/3 of the room raises their hands.
Many years and many movies after Superstar comes Haynes and Vachon's newest collaboration, Carol. When Vachon and Haynes got involved, the film had spent almost two decades in development hell. Screenwriter Phyllis Nagy first wrote an adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith novel on which the film is based in 1997. Producers, directors, and cast members came and went. Finally, in 2013, British producer Liz Carlson, who had labored for years to pull the project together, thought she might be close to success. She had Blanchett attached to play the lead, but then there was another setback. Carlson just happened to mention her troubles to her friend, Christine Vachon.
Liz and I were on the phone together, and she said, "I think we've just lost our director on Carol, and I can't believe it. Finally, like, I have the actor, the script's fantastic, and we're not going to get to make the movie. I don't know what to do." And I said, "Well, you know, we haven't, I mean, it looks like Todd's movie isn't going to go forward either." More as a commiserating thing.
Right.
And then we both were silent for a second, and one of us said, "Let's just show it to Todd."
So you look at the script?
Yeah, I got the script, I got the novel, and went to the Oregon coast. I live in Portland, and went away to just get my head clear and read this remarkable novel that I didn't know about, this Patricia Highsmith, her second novel. It's a really special piece of writing and a really powerful account of falling in love from the perspective almost entirely, in the case of the novel, the perspective of the younger woman in the relationship played by Rooney Mara, the character of Therese. And I thought Phyllis's adaptation was lovely and beautiful, and she had done really smart things with kind of opening it up as a film. And I'd worked with Kate before in my Bob Dylan movie, I'm Not There, and was just bowled over by that experience and what she did in that role. So the opportunity working with Kate again, working with Liz for the first time, bringing Christine on board. Sandy Powell, the costume designer, was also attached to the project at this point, and she's a dear friend and colleague.
I guess the long and short of it is that, I mean, at some point you get the casting, because I'm leading up to the question of the financing, which I understand was not easy at all. And I don't know what number you had in the mind at the beginning, but I think it was supposed to be around 25. Am I right about that? And then it had to be dialed way back?
I think that originally, yes. I think that number nine, Liz and Steve, were trying to make the film for around $25 million. But you have to understand, there was a lot of shifts in the past 10 years. You know, one of the legs has been kicked out from under film financing, which is no more DVDs. So a lot of the movies we used to make at a certain level, we've had to really scale back. And the downward pressure on the budgets is enormous.
So you had thought you would like to shoot in New York, but that became prohibitive, or is that?
There were a few scenarios. I think New York was sort of off the list fairly early as viable places. In fact, when it first came to me, the plan that preceded my entrance onto the scene was really to shoot it in the UK for New York.
And there was a complicated plan of shooting exteriors here and interiors there. And that was sort of the first conversation I had with Liz. I was like, that's not going to fly.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, no, we'll have it all set up for him. And I was like, I just allow me to bring what I know to the table here. It's just, he's just not that kind of filmmaker.
I feel like it wastes resources and energy when you divide your crews up, especially overseas like that. It wasn't going to work for this film. There was a sense of reality that
you wanted
really
a very
wanted
authentic New York of the 50s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't going to be like an earlier film I'd made set in the 1950s, Far From Heaven that is really an artificial view, very self-consciously so, of domestic life in the later 50s, the more full-on Eisenhower 50s, sort of filtered through the references to great, you know, Hollywood filmmakers like Douglas Sirk working in melodrama. This had a very different feel and set time, and it was really almost more about the transition out of the war years from the 40s into the 50s. And so we started to think about where we might do it in North America.
Coming up after a short break, Haynes and Vachon tells us how they found the perfect location to shoot 1950s New York, miles away from New York. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director Todd Haynes and producer Christine Vachon about their movie, Carol, a love story starring Rooney Mara as the aspiring photographer Therese and Cate Blanchett as Carol, a wealthy married woman who takes the much younger Therese out to lunch after a chance encounter at the department store where Therese works.
What do you do on Sundays?
Nothing in particular. What do you do?
Oh, nothing lately. I mean, if you'd like to come visit me sometime, you're welcome to. At least there's some pretty country around where I live.
Much of Carol is set in Manhattan of the 1950s, but the prohibitive cost of filming there forced Haynes and Vachon to search for other options. They ended up in the Midwest.
Well, Ohio has a great tax credit. You know, we knew it was part of the financing plan that we get a good tax credit.
As it is so often these days.
It was very, very aggressive.
Yeah, and it had changed. It had become
right.
More so.
Right. But they saw Cleveland, and then, and I remember I talked to Todd that night, and he was like, I just don't see how to make this work without having to bring so many other resources here. It's like, it's not worth it.
Well, do you think at that point, Todd, I don't even want to do it? Or do you think I need my producer
to
solve it?
I wasn't ready. No, I don't let – I really try to keep that little flame alive because
yeah,
you
weren't
need
there
it.
Yet.
You really need it to get you to the next point. Yeah. But very quickly,
then they
things
went,
changed.
They went to Cincinnati, and Cincinnati was built on a grid system. Mm. And there's a lot of Art Deco, a lot of Art Deco buildings. It even – actually, we didn't use it – but Cincinnati even had a subway system that was built at the same time as New York's
right.
That they ended up not opening because the Depression happened and they ran out of money. But I went down and scouted it for another film.
The things I learn on my show.
Those platforms look just like New York City.
Wow.
I think Cincinnati just showed all these incredible creative potential.
Yeah, we really flipped out within hours of landing there.
And there was an extraordinary film commissioner, and she just was tireless.
Amazing. In
trying to make sure that the film had a great experience. And, you know, the thing about shooting in New York is people don't really want you there.
Right. They don't care if you have a great experience.
I mean, people are a little like, oh, another damn Law and Order on my street corner. I can't get into my bodega. They're not into it. In Cincinnati, it was people were into it. And Kristen, this film commissioner, would, you know, she'd really open doors. Like if a store owner didn't want us to paint his awning, suddenly it was okay. Mm. You know,
She had Kristen. The cool thing about Cincinnati too, in relation to Cleveland, is that it was the underdog of city of the two where film productions
right.
were. They were trying
right.
to attract
they wanted to
film
get
production
something for themselves.
Exactly, and mm-hmm. Cleveland had attracted some big budget studio
deals,
films,
yeah.
some big Hollywood films that were mostly in sound stages or something, and in some stages
right.
that they have in Cleveland. So there was almost that feeling of like, yeah, let's go to the smaller city that doesn't even have a 2-person staff in their film commission, but a
right.
one-woman staff.
Right.
But ultimately, it was a city that was exciting aesthetically for the film, and it felt relevant to this
right.
research that we'd already started to put together.
Now, I don't want to give away what happens in the movie, because I'm sure a bunch of people will yet see it who have not yet seen it. But I haven't read the novel. Is the ending different, or is this not different?
No.
There's different things from the novel to the movie, but not that.
Not that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, because of course we're in 2016. Do you feel that the financing, whatever challenges there were, are that people were just kind of like, lesbian love story, limited appeal? Or do you think that people are finally ready to say a love story?
I think it's sort of easy to just say, oh, no one was interested in a lesbian love story, you know, 15 years ago, and now they are. I think that's a little too reductive. I mean, there's
I'm asking, are they now? But yes,
well,
go
I mean,
ahead.
There's a. I think people are interested in great stories, and it is a great love story. And as you know, as we've been talking a lot about, and I should let Todd talk about this, is love stories really only are effective when there's something that keeps the lovers apart, and it's kind of harder and harder to find that thing that keeps the lovers apart in a contemporary world.
Well, I think there isn't a clear answer. One thing that has come up, and we've had this conversation many times because I've made several films now that are female-driven.
Right.
And I think sometimes, even if the lesbian aspect is actually a kind of distinguishing factor that attracts a novel element to a financier, it's still contradictorily a film that has two women leads in it mm-hmm. and no guys in
right.
major roles.
Exactly.
And so that complete amnesia and cyclical problem where we're sort of reinventing the wheel each time
right.
you have to say no. Stories about women are relevant. Stories about women connect to our lives. And stories about women can be profitable. That sort of repeat process, unfortunately, remains. And I think that was built into it alongside other
right.
kinds of changes. And that in general, sadly, because of shifting modes of viewing product, you know, that's been entertainments of different kinds, dramatic films in general are having a harder time getting financed.
Well, we know that.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I'm wondering what's harder now? Is it stories about women or stories about women, gay people? You know, like, which
I mean,
one is
I think
harder?
It's just, it's part and parcel of the same thing. Like those mid-level studio films
that used to
go to the Oscars don't exist anymore. I mean, we made Still Alice last year. And, you know, our joke about that was, you know, unfortunately, it's not called Still Alice and John, because we're facing those casting pressures.
Mm. Well, so let me just ask, you had to make this for less money than initially thought. We talked about
right.
the DVDs are no longer, the digital
right.
pennies are not making up for the analog dollars or
right.
whatever, even though DVDs are also digital, but you take my
right.
point. Where are we going? I mean, do you worry, Todd? Do you feel like you're obviously very established as an indie filmmaker? There's not like a question of that, but do you think, I don't know, am I going to be starved on every project, or is it just a great creative challenge to do it for less, or?
No, I feel lucky. I think there's always something unexpected around the corner. And I think just simply looking at what's happening on cable and streaming avenues today, like the amount of serious, dramatic, and challenging material that's almost required – the required concept to get anything off the ground on the small screen today, drawing a lot of great energy from independent film and so forth to cable production. What did we hear today? That in this last year, more scripted dramatic shows were produced
right.
twice the amount in 1 year than the last 6 years combined. That's remarkable. And that shows a new, robust, competitive energy to delivering complicated and at times dark and at times challenging material.
Right.
I don't think any of us would have expected that ever.
No.
We couldn't have even imagined it.
No.
When in the days of, you know, new queer cinema at the beginning of the 1990s. So those are things you can't anticipate. And they're great gifts. And I think there's even an energy from what's going on there that might even be trickling back in certain places and in certain occasions to independent film on the big screen,
right.
you know. And really, when I see young people going to Carol and responding to it and feeling like they're aware of the cinematography and the score and the silences between the characters and how much the whole cinematic language sort of congeals for an experience that you can't really get any other way, then you feel like, wow, okay, the medium is not dead yet.
Right.
And it's drawing new followers and young people who want something that they don't always get from more disposable forms of entertainment.
Todd Haynes is the director and Christine Vachon is the producer of Carol. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thanks
Our
so
pleasure.
Much, Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.